Thanks for choosing GoldSeek.com as a trusted source for investing and business news. Today's special guest, Louis Navalier, head of Navalier & Associates. Louis Navalier runs Navalier & Associates and is also editor of four leading stock advisory newsletters. Welcome back, Louis Navalier.
Great to be here.
You know, I wanted to talk to you about your latest report. You talk about corporate earnings. Now, clearly, this is a key component to every equities bull market. You know, after all, even Warren Buffett has shown for decades that steady, predictable earnings, a key to success. Although it's not as sexy maybe as the high-flying stocks, the reliability of earnings seems to win in the long run. In your latest newsletter, you do outline how this is the best announcement season that you've seen in years. Tell us some more, please.
You know, I just finished doing my emerging growth letter. To say the earnings are strong is a bit of an understatement. My average sales this last quarter were up 70.6%, and earnings were up a whopping 374.4%. Now, that's as good as it's ever going to get. For the third quarter, they're supposed to decelerate. Sales are supposed to decelerate to an annual pace of 52.6, and earnings are supposed to decelerate to about 147.8. Now, I have earnings surprise on average. The analysts will revise their estimates higher, so I'll probably do better than that. But the reason earnings momentum has just peaked here is the dollar's gotten strong. And earnings were being fueled by a weak dollar that was driving commodity prices higher. And companies were reaping windfall profits from their overseas business. So all of a sudden now we're more in a deflationary environment where we've got falling food and energy prices, and earnings will decelerate here a bit even though the economy looks fine. But the other good thing that's going on is they can't raise rates. Britain and the U.S. said they're going to raise rates. Now they say, no, not till wages go up. And global yields collapsed in August, you know, when the German 10-year bond crossed below 1%. It's almost been cut in half this year. And now there's this global capital flight, all this, these trillions of dollars that central banks have pumped in and sloshing all over the place. And one of the recipients is the U.S. stock market. And that's why we went up in August in light volume. It's a very, very exciting time.
I wonder if you could outline a few companies with solid prospects. I know that you keep a core group without giving anything proprietary away. Maybe a few companies that you like.
Well, let's talk about, I have a little drone company. I have a big one called Northrop Grumman, makes the Global Hawk drone. But my little one is AVAV. That's AeroVironment. Apple Victor. They just reported 35% sales growth. Their earnings were up even in a more impressive 1,000%. And there's not good analyst estimates on this company, but they're a classic example of one I expect a surprise from. Because last I saw, the drone business is pretty good, especially at police departments and things like that. Another good example of a company that's supposed to have just blowout earnings is Ring Energy, REI. Their sales forecast the next quarter is supposed to be up 408%. Earnings are supposed to be up 1,550%. Obviously, they got a bunch of new wells on, and I know gas and crude oil prices are soft, but you know they got all these new wells coming on board, and so they're going to have just stunning sales and earnings growth. So, you know, the fracking business is very, very good. Our biggest winner, which we still like, in fact, we bought more of it today, is Vishop Holdings, VIPS. This is a Chinese, basically a Chinese Amazon, but they make money. You know, Amazon in the United States forgets to make money every now and then. And their sales are forecast to be up 125% next quarter, and their earnings are supposed to be 183%. So it's just stunning. I mean, it's just stunning. So I've got lots of earnings. Earnings are not a problem. The biggest problem we have is that we're starting to enter a deflationary environment, so we're going to have to be very careful of some of our energy-related stocks. But this looks awfully good right now.
Tell us some more about deflationary environment. You know, you talk about the Fed holding rates low for the foreseeable future in the newsletter because they keep rattling that saber with regard to higher rates. But the other side of the pond there, the ECB lowered its rates now, as I know you know, into negative territory. First time that I can remember in history that a major central bank lowered rates below zero.
Our Fed's being somewhat responsible by trying to wind down quantitative easing. It should be wound down by our October. Now, because they've done all this money pumping, they've gone from a $800 billion balance sheet in 2008 to a $4.5 trillion balance sheet. And they've taken over $2 trillion of that to shore up the mortgage-backed market. It just doesn't hit on all cylinders now. So they tried to save that market, and they were successful. But they're not going to give all this money back. They're going to keep that $4.5 trillion balance sheet. With interest, we'll get up to $5 trillion. And they're going to continue to manipulate interest rates. The big problem and the big event that caused the market to rally in August was European yields. Even though our GDP resurged to a 4% annual pace in the second quarter, that was a preliminary number, it's going to get revised, Europe basically went into recession. You've got Germany, France, and Italy all either flat or contracting. That freaked everybody out. Their yields plummeted. And the European Central Bank is out of control on their money pumping. You know, they basically told their member banks to go ahead and borrow at 1% and go buy the government bonds. So they drove the bond yields for Greece, Italy, Portugal, Spain dramatically lower. You know, Spain bond yields, 10-year bond yields, fell below U.S. yields this year. And, in fact, Spain's at the lowest interest rate since 1789. And that's trillions of dollars. The banks in Europe are so busy arbitraging, you know, borrowing from the ECB at 1% and buying something with a higher yield, they forgot how to lend. So they would park their excess reserves with the European Central Bank, and they charge them negative rates. And then basically the ECB is saying, hey, go out and lend this money. Well, guess what happens when you're lazy? You don't want to do that. So all of a sudden the U.S. dollar started to rally, so they just started to dump their money over here. So they're getting a currency tailwind, okay? Plus they're buying our yields, and they're going lower, which is a short-term appreciation. And so it's the European money that is actually driving our yields now lower. And, you know, it's a very small world out there. It's pretty amusing. So, you know, our central bank action was coordinated, and it seems to be not coordinated anymore, although they just got together at Jackson Hole in Wyoming, and I think they had a little chat now that they're a little bit more coordinated all of a sudden.
This month is a particularly challenging one for Wall Street. Traders on sabbatical. You also point out that the lull could be a good buying opportunity, though, for conservative A-rated stocks.
We should rally go into Labor Day weekend like we go into most holiday weekends. If you look, we rallied into Memorial Day weekend. We rallied in July 4th weekend. We're going to rally into Labor Day weekend because people are going to be happy. We will cringe around September 11th because of all the chaos in the world, but that'll be a good buying opportunity then. Hopefully nothing bad will happen. But the drop-dead date for everybody to get in, the last person in the pool, is September 30th. So historically, in a midterm election year, September 30th has been the best buying point, and we rally going into the midterm elections. Obviously, we're going to have more gridlock after the midterms, as you do in most midterms. Wall Street loves gridlock. Apparently, government can't do anything. And so the private sector will just grow and prosper regardless of government. And then we get all the seasonal surge. We're still going to have a very good third quarter earnings announcement season. Not quite as strong as it was in the second quarter. But and then you hit the happy time of year. You know, from Thanksgiving of the year, the markets traditionally rally. There's year-end pension funding. People are happy in the holidays, and that rubs off on the stock market, and you often have a nice small cap rally. I mean, August has been very significant because we've rallied with no volume. And so August was really capital flight from fixed income investors seeking yield. You know, stock market still yields over 2%. That's more than the bank. It's tax advantaged. But it was really not only U.S. capital flight, international capital flight, and then, of course, if we can rally with no volume in the seasonally strongest month, it's a big deal. And corporate buybacks are definitely picking up. CNBC's out there broadcasting buybacks are slowing down. They don't know what happened in August. They're going off old data. I can tell you, because I have 37 stocks buying back $1 billion or more a year, the buybacks picked up big time in August.
And you show quite an interesting graphic there, which illustrates the significance of buybacks relative to stocks. But I wonder if you could give us more of a specific view of how this fuels value. I mean, obviously, there's fewer shares out there. Supply and demand dictates that we'll have a higher price. Tell us more, please.
Well, sure. One of the more controversial stocks I own is Lockheed Martin. It yields about over 3%. It's retired almost 40% of its float. So what people don't realize is that we may be cutting back, but our allies are buying like crazy. And, of course, there's all that tension in the world, so that's good. And then finally, So that gets their sales up. But Lockheed's a huge IT company. They have been stabilizing their stock with their dividend and relentless stock buybacks. Their dividend payouts are actually lower than they were a few years ago because they bought back over 40% of their stock. But when a CFO buys back his stock, his earnings per share go up. So let's just say earnings are flat, okay, and he buys back 10% of outstanding stock, his earnings per share will go up 10%. So relentless corporate buybacks are boosting their underlying earnings per share. Now, a lot of people will say, well, this is financial engineering. This is smoke and mirrors. Well, yeah, it is. But every kid that goes to business school learns about finance 101, whether they should borrow in the debt or equity markets. And what happens is if Wall Street doesn't price your stock right, and you have my average large cap stock has a return equity of 28%, and if they can borrow at 3 or 4 and buy their stock back with that high return equity, their earnings per share is going to soar. And so when you have relatively low price earnings ratios, as we do now, you know, our average large cap stocks barely at 15 times forecasted earnings, and you can borrow at such low rates, you're going to keep borrowing, buying your stock back. My average large cap stock is going to be gone in 18 years. It looks like the buyback pace is picking up, so I'm going to have to revise that to 15 years. So it's whether this is right or wrong, this is what's happening, and this is a big, big deal. And that's why every dip is a buying opportunity, and that's why the market can't have a big correction, because corporate America is waiting for every little dip out there to buy their stock back.
I want all of our listeners to really digest what you've pointed out, because I think this is key. Essentially, you like the fact that we have a low interest rate environment, because this allows big caps in particular with strong return on equities to have a cash buffer between what they're borrowing at and the liquidity and cash that they have on hand. That is cash that has to be put to use, and we don't have a rip-roaring economy, so they're buying back their shares.
Correct. And, you know, corporate America also has two sets of books. They have domestic treasury and international treasury. And so, you know, a lot of people wondered, how did Navalier end up in Reno, Nevada? Well, it's pretty simple. I'm from California, and guess where the California companies and the big Washington companies like Microsoft keep their cash? Reno, okay? Apple, Cisco, Oracle, Intel, the Intuit founders, my neighbor. Microsoft's the biggest employer there, and Amazon's huge there. So they're running their cash through Reno because they don't want to have the corporate taxes on their domestic revenue. Now, what's happening is then they have their international treasury. Now, that's going to be in Ireland or Singapore or someplace else. Now, as these companies build up all this cash overseas, it burns a hole in their pocket, and it's fine if they want to expand. They will not repatriate that money because they don't want to pay the tax differential. You know, so if you pay 25%, say, in Canada, and you want to bring it back to the United States, you got to pay another 14%. So what they do is they leave that cash overseas, it burns a hole in their pocket, and they often will use that money to buy their stock back and or, okay, use that collateral over there to borrow extra cheap over here, which is exactly what Apple did. You know, Apple got up to $179 billion overseas, so they could just borrow extra cheap because they have all this money sloshing over there. So, you know, there's this big gossip about inversions and all that stuff. I can tell you, the S&P 500 is not chartered in the United States anymore. It's been gone for years, okay? Don't ask me why the financial media is talking about this now. They left a long time ago. You cannot find a big U.S. energy company headquartered in the United States. They're, you know, Halliburton's Qatar, Transocean is Swiss.
But what about Sunoco? I love Sunoco.
Well, you know, I have to check that. You know, MEMC Electronics, Mountain View, California, that's Cayman Islands. Seagate Technology was Ireland for a long time. I mean, just don't be surprised, okay? So, you know, obviously a lot of the pharmaceutical companies are Irish, you know. But the bottom line is, you know, these companies go to the low tax havens, they keep their cash there, that cash has been burned a hole in their pocket, and if they don't know how to invest it, they just buy their stock back. So the buybacks are not, I don't see them ending. I mean, you know, if Wall Street doesn't price a stock properly, corporate America has every right to go back and buy their stock back, and that's exactly what's happening. So this is very, very exciting. This is not being told by the media. You know, Herb Greenberg loves to get up and demonize buybacks.
Also wanted to ask you about the, the latest Fed's minutes there. I mean, we saw a sea change, you might say, at least in the general sentiment, and we're starting to hear some hawkish talk coming from the Fed. But you aren't buying it. You think this is, they're just trying to talk the markets down. What do you think?
Well, first of all, the hawks are a minority at the Fed. And Charles Posner, I believe, voted against what the Fed statement was last time. He's to say he's hot as a pistol is an understatement. He's PO'd, okay? So the bottom line is you have a lot of progressive people at the Fed trying to fix everything by throwing money at it. And Janet Yellen, our new Fed chairman, is a labor economist. And she came up with her own indicator, 19-component indicator, to explain that even though the unemployment rate fell, the job market isn't fixed and the Fed hasn't fulfilled its unemployment mandate. So she's looking at there's too many temp jobs. You know, a lot of companies are still keeping people under 30 hours a week because they don't want to pay for their health care because the costs are uncertain. Even if the costs were certain, there's a Cadillac tax coming in 2018. I know I'm personally going to get hit with that for my health plan. It's too generous. I mean, I got to strip something out like anesthesia or something. But I think the government makes me have that anyway. So they're going to try to throw me to an exchange. So, because our health plan is just too generous. So what's happened is they're keeping the people under 30 hours a week. The labor force participation is at a 36-year low. And the most ironic thing is the folks over 55 are working more than ever. Now, there's this myth that the labor force participation is at a 36-year low because the baby boom's turning gray. But then how come everybody over 55 is working more than ever? So in this era where, 80's the new 60 because you can't retire with low rates, the job market is really, really messed up right now. There's no wage growth, which is really Yellen's big thing. There's too many temp jobs. And the core of the workforce, 25 to 54, is not recovered yet, okay? There was some hope in recent months, but it's just not recovered. So until we get some wage growth and more full-time jobs, they're going to keep pumping, and this could be for years. And I don't mean to be political on you, but, Eric Cantor is the guy that was close to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and he got defeated because he wanted this immigration reform. Because you had companies like Darden Restaurants and Marriott pushing him big time that we need more foreigners and temporary work visas. And, I happen to live in South Florida, so I see this. You go to hotels, you go to restaurants, you'll get people that are from somewhere else, South Africa or Peru or some other place, and they're there for 6 months and they disappear. And you see the same thing at a ski resort. A foreigner on a temporary work visa is cheaper than hiring an American or legal alien. Because if you hire an American or legal alien and you let them go when the season turns down, you've got to give them unemployment. The whole hotel and restaurant business has figured this out, okay, and so is the ski industry. So what's happened is we need more of those foreigners and temporary work visas, at least the big companies are lobbying Congress for it, and that's been pushing the immigration reform under the surface. Obviously, it didn't get through because Eric Cantor got lost, but this is one of the things that, still might get through.
But what do you say to folks who point to Canada, which has relatively low immigration, but, the younger crowd fills that void for menial or, let's say, manual labor? They pick in the fields. They work in the hotels. They work, behind the scenes, busing tables. The argument that's being made there is this creates a, let's call it an economic backstop for the middle class.
Well, let me be very clear on Canada. I know Canada a little bit too well. My wife's Canadian. In fact, I can still make my kids Canadian before they're 18 if I wanted to, in case there's a draft or something. But the truth of the matter is Canada doubled its population in the last 30 years, and they did double it with very orderly immigration. But the Canadian immigration is a little different. They basically, when you're up there, they say, got any money? 475, I think, now. Mm-hmm. But it used to be a quarter million. And so basically, you can immigrate there if you bring money. Now, you can immigrate to the United States if you bring money, too. Okay, and I personally think the easiest way to solve all our fiscal problems is to let about 100 million new immigrants in with 2 million each. And also, you want all those people that go to our fancy universities to basically give them a work visa if possible. If you go to Microsoft and Redmond, it is India. For some reason, India makes more programmers than other countries. So Redmond is India. Well, they can't get all the programmers in, so they got them up in British Columbia. And it's going to get to the point where Microsoft's going to be a lot bigger outside of the United States than in it, and that's all because of the work visa problem. So It's interesting what's happening in America, but I think we do want to look to Canada. You know, whether we like it or not, Social Security and some of these other things seem to be a pyramid scheme, so we need to get more people paying in, and that's another thing we might want to do.
Well, you know, I will point back to India and just note that for decades, there was a huge push for technical skills, particularly with programming, all throughout the country there. If you had one of the higher scores in your community, you could get an almost fully paid spot at the university. So it really drove that programming / computering skill set for decades. Also wanted to ask you a bit more, though, about this inflation outlook. Rates and inflation will be back on the table as, I think, a key component in the markets.
Normally, the money pumping results of inflation, but the velocity of money, how fast money changes hands, is turned down. So near term, what's happened is the dollar rally, last I looked at, euro's at a one-year low and the dollar's at a one-year high. The dollar rally is shoving all commodity prices down. Doesn't matter whether it's precious metals, wheat, corn, soybeans. There are exceptions. Copper prices are up. Beef prices are still high. Hog prices are firm. But the truth of the matter is that the strong dollar caused food and energy prices to decline near term. So, and also, this is the time of year where energy will turn down. Turns down in the fall. We've had an unusually cool summer. It's global cooling, I guess, is going to cause it to turn down a bit. But in the fall, naturally does that. So it's gone for now, but it will come back. You just can't have all this money sloshing around not cause inflation.
Well, you know, I'd also point to palladium, which, as you know, Russia, the number one producer, there's some concern there could be supply disruption issues due to the Ukraine drama.
And platinum as well, because platinum comes from Russia and South Africa, and South Africa likes to have like a 40-day strike.
Yep, they just wrapped up the latest. Okay, I want to ask you, though, about your geopolitical standpoint. Now, we're seeing a lot of trouble in the Ukraine standoff. We also have Gaza, and then we have Iraq, a trifecta, if you will. Tell us more.
I should be very, very careful. I bought a whole bunch of defense stocks early this year. Didn't they know that this is the most peaceful time in history? Okay, well, what's happening is they're selling to our allies because of all the tension in the world. Now that tension is broken out. We're very proud that we own Raytheon, which is the Iron Dome of protecting Israel. And, you know, what Israel does is if a missile's coming in and it's going to land in the field, they won't shoot it down. But if it's going to go to an urban area, they'll shoot it down. It's 20 grand to shoot down each one. So Raytheon's done very, very well. The spy business is great. So the drone business, Northrop Grumman, AVAV, that small drone company, it's just phenomenal. Finally, IT business is good. Spine is good, as Lockheed Martin is. I've got a HII, which does all the Navy ships. Had very good earnings. Astronix, another new one I'm adding. They're selling a lot to the Defense Department. There may be a void in the world. We may not be protecting as many people as we used to, but the arms business is very good. In fact, I actually bicycle with a guy who was sanctioned by the UN and is an arms dealer. He's happy. This is the greatest environment it's ever been for him, and he just thinks Putin's a great guy. I mean, because it's good for his business. So it's what's happened in the Ukraine is very tragic. Obviously, Russia wants their oil pipelines, or their natural gas pipelines to be flowing freely. There was an alternative pipeline they were trying to build around Ukraine that they're not too crazy about. They know Europe's not going to do a lot, but Russia did hurt their currency when they did this. They joined the emerging market crisis, and what's going on is not very acute. Now, as far as Gaza's concerned, I mean, obviously, you've got to take out Hamas, and because they're launching missiles, and the head of Hamas is worth $2.6 billion. Arafat, used to live in Switzerland. So it's unfortunate that they've had these leaders that are, less than ideal, but they've signed their death warrant. And then we'll see what happens with ISIS now. I mean, obviously we're trying to protect the Kurds, and we got the dam back, and we'll have to see how all this unfolds. The world's a bit of a mess. And the sirens go off, you got 15 seconds for all the shrapnel comes down. I go to Israel a lot. It's a long story why I go there, but you got to get underground. You got to get somewhere safe because even when you shoot it down, the shrapnel's coming.
Any positive comments? My guess is that you'll be looking for some type of capitulation in the next 6 to 12 months in the precious metals that might lead to a bargain buying opportunity.
Well, you know, gold never did retest its low. It might have to do that. But, you know, the chaos in the world is good for the precious metals. I just think they're reacting negatively to the dollar right now. You know, it's I think as the chaos builds, you know, it might firm up a bit. You know, the Indian wedding season is over. You've had some central bank selling that hurt the gold market. We took the sanctions off of Iran. Iran was doing oil for gold deals. Now we do oil, they do oil for dollar deals. So, you know, it's interesting. You know, gold's just in a trading range, and I think people have to realize that. But if the market's going to go down for about 14 days, I guarantee you gold will be the best performer. And as you mentioned, the platinum, the palladium plays, those are industrial metals that everybody needs, and the supply sources are very suspect right now. So those are not bad places to and the other precious metals to look at. Silver is just much more volatile. I wish I could give people good advice on silver. My main advice is just take gold and make it three times more volatile.
Well, I wonder if you could tell folks more about the services that you provide at Navalier Advisor.
We're a money management firm. We manage a few billion dollars. We don't count our bond business, which is over $1 billion a year, but basically we're a money management firm. We have a free stock grader out there that people want to take advantage of. Our dividend grader launches in early September. You have to grade stocks differently for dividends than you do for stocks. So at NavaliergRowth.com, you can go there and see how your stocks rank. If you would like us to do the portfolio checkup for you, we're honored to do that. We give free portfolio checkups. But we are an institutional manager. We have big institutional accounts, billion-dollar accounts. We charge pretty low fees if we do manage money, but the other thing that's odd about us is we're one of the few managers who work for an incentive fee. We like to charge 10% of profits once a year. The SEC restricts on who's available for that, but that's become very popular on fixed income or dividend type accounts nowadays. Fees are a very sensitive issue on yield, so we prefer to just charge 10% of profits once a year, and we wait a whole year to bill. And then I'm a huge investor myself. You know, it's... yeah, I have a new fund out there I started. It's my third fund. It's growing rapidly. I have money in all my funds, so we have a lot of fun out there.
Louis Navalier, we want to thank you for your time and also a hat tip for being one of the sharpest advisors with a really solid track record. Very difficult industry to have that moniker, and we're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com radio.
Great. An honor.